The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
We shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
American prosperity is the bedrock of freedom and security all over the world.
An obligation to the heritage of liberty and dignity handed down to us by our forefathers.
It's time for the Pro-America Report with Ed Martin on The Answer San Diego.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Pro-America Report. This is Ryan Height again filling in for Mr. Ed Martin this week on the program, and I am glad to be with you here for another day, another great day of some fun things for us to talk about. Well, I say fun things. There's some not-so-fun things. There's some fun things. If you like politics like I do, though, it's an election year. And today, of all days, it's an election day. There's a lot of municipal elections, school board, and mayors, and aldermen, and all sorts of fun things that you should be involved in. So we're going to come back and talk about that real quick at the end of the program. But I have something else that we need to cover for the wink. Something else, actually, you know, Ed may not be here with us on the show, but he is still with us here in news. Not in spirit, you heard me right, in news, because he has a guest piece this week over on AMAC that we want to talk about real quick. But before we get into it, let me tell you about ProAmericaReport.com, PhyllisSchlafly.com, two websites that you, I hope, are very familiar with at this point. These are two places you want to go because at PhyllisSchlafly.com, of course, you will find the archives of this program, all of the podcasts, the standalone segments of the guests, lots of links and resources, and of course, the all-important wink email, what you need to know every morning into your inbox. I promise you won't regret it. It'll be a great addition to your morning routine. But of course, also at ProAmericaReport.com, you can find Ed's Substack, what he is writing about, what he's talking about. Often it coincides with this, obviously, ProAmerica Report, sharing the name. So we're sharing a lot of the same talking points, information, things that you really do need to know about, giving you an analysis of what's happening, not just the headlines that you could go and find from any old place, but what it actually means and what all it's connected to. And I tell you what, that's something that we want to talk about today, something that I think is incredible. Important that we must understand. It's got a lot of long-reaching tentacles. This topic, yes, but more than that, the tentacles go beyond it to the deep state that we're going to talk about. And I know this is such an interesting topic because labels are a funny thing, aren't they? The deep state, the establishment, in her book, A Choice Not an Echo, which she published 60 years ago this year, Phyllis Schlafly called them the kingmakers. These elitist people, these forces, these groups, those who think that they ought to assume and retain the laurels of power in America and influence and wealth, even though we are a representative republic where citizens, and this is how it's supposed to work, citizens ought to go and have a season of service, a time of service, representing their fellow citizens in the legislature or in an executive role, whether that's in the county executive or all the way up to a state or to the federal level. This is how that is supposed to work, a season of service where we have a citizen-based legislature, but it has turned into that all-encompassing nasty word, career politicians. This has turned into a career for most people. Elected office. Now, fine. Maybe there's some positions that are appointed, not elected, that you would have kind of a career out of because it makes sense. Engineers, people who build things, who work on our infrastructure, the military. These are places where we have a different system. But in the elected offices, it is a button. We could talk about those, make a case for something here or there, this way or that. But in the elected offices, there is no case to be made except for a citizen legislature or a citizen-led, a representative government that people go and serve and then they're done. It's not their time anymore. It's time for someone else to come. Well, the ruling class, the deep state, the establishment, whatever you want to call it, I'm going to say the deep state for the rest of our time here together. The deep state does not let go very easily, and this is what you need to know today. When Donald Trump wins this fall, not if, notice I say when, and that's not just hope. I truly believe that that kind of landslide is coming. Also, I believe that we have to make it happen. But that's a personal, you know, I think that has to happen. But when Donald Trump wins this fall, the deep state must be burned out of every nook and cranny of federal government. Now, that is no easy task, mind you. We are looking at a system that has entrenched itself, not just over a few years, over decades, really probably over, you know, the better part of a century. We are looking at a system that has not only wound its tentacles into every area of government, into many areas of our life, but it has found a way to replicate itself, and it has found a way to ensure that even as we have a transition of power in our representative republic, that it, the deep state, the ruling class, supposed ruling class, aspiring ruling class, that they stay the same, that that system protects itself from the natural term limiting and the natural turnover of power that our republic gives us, that our representative system gives us every 2 and 4 and 6 years. And that is something that Donald Trump, when he wins, God willing, in November, is going to have to deal with at new levels. We saw it in 2016, and I think that there are incredibly valuable lessons that must be learned from that first Trump transition. Now, this is spurred by a couple of things, a couple of articles this week. First of all, on a lighter note, we saw that Mitch McConnell this week announced his intention to remain in the Senate. You may have seen, we talked about, he announced he was stepping down from Senate leadership. He'll no longer be the Republican leader of the Senate. To which we all said, great, it's time for new leadership, new blood. No. Mitch McConnell, who's 82, by the way, intends to remain in the U.S. Senate. Why, you ask? Probably so that he can continue to oppose conservatives and that he can, do all kinds of things that are against the interests of the United States. Heaven forbid that he would leave and, I don't know, Tom Massey or someone else from Kentucky could run. And then we'd have another, you know, a compartment, or not a compartment. We'd have a partner for Rand Paul in the Senate from Kentucky that is worthy of Rand's independence and principle. But no. Mitch McConnell is going to stay. So that's just great. You see that. And I thought, you know, never mind then. There isn't going to be a significant transfer of power inside Senate Republicans. Mitch McConnell may be officially stepping down as the GOP leader, but he's not leaving the Senate. So there you go. They're replicating themselves. But Ed had a great article at AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens. There's some really neat stuff going on over there, even if it's not something that you want to join just yet, or maybe you don't identify as needing to join. But, you know, that's not my business. That's up to you. But they have their newsline has a really great section that talks, across the economy, education, elections, national security, society. Ed had a piece there this week at AMAC, AMAC.us, AMAC.us, pardon me, AMAC.us. Trump transition should anticipate deep state shenanigans. And Ed makes a fantastic case. This worry of the holdovers from one administration to the next, this isn't anything new. I mean, this goes all the way back to his point to the transition from John Adams to Thomas Jefferson. That transfer of power was essentially one of the first times in human history that this peaceful transition of power happened from one party to another, from one ideology or group to another. You know, moving from even Washington to Adams wasn't as fear-loaded as the switch was from Adams to Jefferson, this transition between two different political parties in America. So it was definitely a worry then. And it is now even more of a worry. But here's the deal. And this blows my mind. And Ed brought this up, but I've talked about this before, I think, on the program here. But I mean, you know, back then, at that point, at that juncture in American history, in 1801, John Adams to Thomas Jefferson, the transition took place. At that point, the federal government had fewer than 150 non-military employees. 150, fewer than 150 employees. There were only just over, it was about 5.3 million citizens at that point. Well, now, and that's roughly one federal employee per about 35,000 citizens. Well, today, we have 2.25 million federal employees for just over 340 or so million citizens. That is one federal employee for every 152 Americans. I want to know, where's my, that feels like I should have a personal representative. Is that how that works? If there's only 152, I should have someone that I call, like my personal rep in the federal government. I feel like with how much I pay in taxes that could be a possibility. Maybe you agree with me. I don't know. I feel like it. But think about it. 2,250,000 federal employees. This is a huge behemoth of a thing to try to change over the transition of power from one party to another party, from one ideology to another. What we saw in 2016 was worse than any of the shenanigans before it. We remember a lot of the nastiness between the Clinton to the George W. Bush administration. What happened to Trump in 2016 was worse. They carved out and isolated him from good voices and good advisors. And make no mistake, now in the last few years, as they've revealed even more of their hand in the last 8 years, it will be even worse this time. We need some serious protections and precautions set up. And when he gets in, there must be some serious burning out of the infection that is the deep state across our federal government. It's got to happen. There you go. That's what you need to know. Stick around. We got a couple of great guests. And of course, I'll be back to wrap up the show. You don't want to miss any of it. ProAmericaReport.com, PhyllisSchlafly.com. And I'll see you right back here after the break on the Pro America Report.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Our next guest is Dr. Jeffrey E. Paul. He's a professor of social philosophy in the Social Philosophy and Policy Center at West Virginia University. It's in the John Chambers College of Business. He has been a research professor in Arizona. He's been all over the place teaching and writing. And his book, which is out, and I have a copy of, and thankfully, Dr. Paul, I got a copy, hardback copy, which I like very much, which is makes me even happier to read it, as well as an e-copy. And I read it. The book is called Winning America's Second Civil War, Progressivism's Authoritarian Threat, Where It Came From and How to Defeat It. So welcome, Dr. Paul. How are you, sir?
Very good.
So I think this is a very helpful book because it explains how we ended up with this craziness at the universities, especially the universities, and it walks through that. Give us a summary of that. It's over 100 years old, this onslaught of America, and we're seeing the sort of bitter fruit today. But walk us through that. I think it really helps people understand.
Yeah, the country was founded on singular principles. That by singular, I mean that there was no predecessor like it,
right,
in the history of the world, and has been no successor since. And it was founded on the view that individuals have a right to themselves. They have a right of self-ownership, sometimes referred to as the right to life. But what that meant was self-ownership. And prior to that, in all societies, they were ultimately owned by the ruler, the sovereign, the emperor, the pharaoh, etc. So this was unprecedented, what was being claimed in the United States as the founding principle. So everyone was entitled to themselves and entitled to their liberty and therefore entitled to the fruits of their labor. That was what the country was founded on. It was viewed that individuals could coalesce and form a government for the protection of those rights, or the individual could choose not to and defend them on their own. It's more efficient to do it with a government. So that's what the founders did. They established a new government in the United States, And that view was the general view in the United States when it was founded. It was the authoritative view in the United States, and it was the prevailing view through the Civil War. And of course, that view led to the Civil War because the country had been founded with slavery, which was a complete flouting of the founding principle of self-ownership. After the Civil War was completed and these rights were entirely secure for the entire population, within about 10 years, the view of the founders was completely rejected in one but significant sector of the country's institutions, and that was its colleges and universities. It happened abruptly and accidentally, and that's the shocking fact. What happened was American colleges and universities were not research institutions. They were just teaching institutions, pedagogical institutions, but no research was being done there and so forth. And therefore, no doctorates were being awarded. There were a few exceptions to that, but they were rare. So the American academics, the presidents of these institutions, felt that they had to be upgraded. And they had to be upgraded in emulation of the only country that had had doctoral programs for 200 years, and that was Germany. And so they decided to import Americans who had received German doctorates into their institutions and start graduate programs at each of their institutions. They did that. Effectively, that gave these Americans trained in Germany a monopoly over higher education. The monopoly was fine in the natural sciences and engineering and so forth and medicine, the empirical sciences.
Right.
But in the social sciences and the humanities, it was a disaster because the Germans had exactly the antithesis in their views about society and what was the correct set of political principles. They were the antithesis of the American founding principles. And they basically, to try to simplify it as much as possible, the Germans regarded nations as one would think of organisms. They thought of them as organisms in which individual human beings, were merely the cellular units, and right, therefore obligated to keep the organism alive. And to do so, they were to follow the dictates of the brain, and the brain was comprised of the faculty of these universities. So basically, individuals had no rights, only duties to obey. And most of the German professoriate were socialists. They called themselves state socialists. They used the German term for that. When their students got to the United States, returned to the United States, they couldn't describe themselves as socialists, which was an odious term in the United States. So they had to disguise what they were by adopting another term of description. The term they adopted was progressive. Hmm. And they got that term. They borrowed it from one of the German political parties, the German Progress Party. So they called themselves progressives and disguised themselves by using that term and also by giving a description of their position which avoided the differences between it, publicly gave a description of their positions, which avoided the antithesis between their position and the founding position. They discussed that with among themselves in their journals and so forth, but not publicly. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of Americans began to study at universities and colleges, which they hadn't done up until the last quarter of the 19th century and into the 20th. That ideology, the ideology of progressivism, spread. and infected both parties initially, but became the acquired complete control of one of the parties in the New Deal, and that was the Democratic Party. And that control that it had over the Democratic Party spread from the presidency down to the membership. And so it now dominates one party. Some who are aligned with the original.
We were talking with Dr. Jeffrey E. Paul, a professor at West Virginia University, and Counter Books, by the way, is the publisher of this book, Winning America's Second Civil War. I think it's helpful to follow that path. But what your central thesis is, well, the Second Civil War is a war of ideas. That book, you say, your book is about ideas, and the idea is the founding. You know, the founding setup versus this progressive setup. And those two are they irreconcilable? In other words, is it a war where somebody's got to win? They cannot exist in tandem, because they ultimately, the progressive leads to the destruction of the other, if you look at it backwards now, is that a weakness of the founding vision? Was it, it allowed sort of freedom and institutions to develop that basically are undermining its very sort of central thesis?
Let me take your first question. They are irreconcilable.
Okay.
And in fact, I would describe contemporary America coming up to this election.
Dr. Paul, let me do something. I'm going to take a brief break real quick, and we'll come back and keep going, because I want to keep going. So just hold on. We're talking again with Dr. Jeffrey Paul. His book is Winning America's Second Civil War. Don't forget where we are, Dr. Paul, because this is an important point. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. We'll be back in just one moment. Welcome back. Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Dr. Paul, but I knew we'd get a hard break and I'd get trouble from my folks. So the book is Winning America's Second Civil War by Dr. Jeffrey Paul. Back to what you were saying, if you can. I'm sorry to have interrupted you, that they are irreconcilable is the point. And go ahead. Let me make sure you finish before I follow up.
Yeah, they're irreconcilable. You can't have the rights that founders believe that all human beings had, when the other side believes there are no rights, but only a duty to obey. There's no way of reconciling the two. And the history of Germany in the early 1930s and then into the late 1930s is an illustration of what can happen when basically such a view becomes the dominant view in a society. So I think we're in a very perilous position today, far more perilous than we have been at any time in our history. That's my view. And the peril has been increasing ever since the last quarter of the 19th century. And nobody knew or understood what had transpired in the universities, except for one man. There was a man named Herbert Tuttle, who was the most eminent historian of Germany in the United States. And he warned in 1883 in the Atlantic Monthly exactly what would happen. It was an exact forecast of what was going to happen to the university and the country if it kept importing these Americans trained in Germany. So that's what I would have to say about that.
Dr. Jeffrey Paul is our guest. The book is Winning America's Second Civil War. All right, so what do you do about it? You know, I mean, to me, the most glaring exposure of the problem in the last couple of years has been the universities, and there's probably other ones, but it seems to me that people can kind of get that. But on one hand, it looks like they're teaching a system that's incompatible with America's continuing, you know, success. On the other hand, they are what they are. They're the universities where everybody goes and everybody is indoctrinated. What do you do?
Well, there's the question of what you do about the universities, but then there's a larger question, since it would, any kind of attempt at reform, if it was successful, it would take several generations to be successful. There's an immediate peril, and I could talk about the universities, but let me just talk about
go broadly, yep.
Peril and how I would address it. My view is that the Republican Party, which is the non-autocratic party, whatever its flaws, it's not dominated by this point of view. The other party is hopeless and can't really be reformed this time. So the Republican Party has to get a majority of the voters, and it won't just get it by the kind of contest that we see transpiring now. It probably will get a majority. Trump probably will win, but we don't know that to be the case. So the Republicans need an issue which will automatically gain the allegiance of a majority of voters. What would that be? And I put it at the end of my book. It's why I proposed it. I worked with three economists, and what we found, if we supplanted the current tax system, the whole of it, the whole thing, the income tax, the personal income tax, the corporate income tax, the payroll tax on both sides, the capital gains tax, the estate tax, the gift tax, and replace it with a 1% universal sales tax. That means all expenditures, not just retail sales, but all expenditures of any kind, like all the ones that are made in financial markets, stocks, bonds, derivatives, and so on. If you taxed all of that at 1%, you would get more revenue than is current being raised by the current system. And at the same time, individuals all the way down to the least wealthy of individuals would have retained income that is far higher than the income that they have after taxes today. And it would be enormously popular. Therefore, in the middle class, the majority of people who vote in this country, than the current system. And if the Republicans took it up, they would get a majority and explained its effects, explained how it would benefit every individual who is now being burdened with the federal income tax. And so that's what I propose immediately. Now, I do propose other reforms of the universities and the Supreme Court and other institutions. But I realize that those are not going to be transformed overnight. And I also should mention that what the universities have done is they've corrupted the rest of society. That's why the media, 95% of the media is just like 95% of the academy. It's dominated by people from this one sector of the political spectrum that made its way into the country in the late 19th century. That's why you don't get a diversity of opinions on television or the newspapers and so on. You have to go on the internet to get a diversity of views about current news. So that's what I propose. There are things that can be done with public universities, and I think the federal government should not be giving any university, public or private, any support whatever. And it's spending a huge billions and billions of dollars on the universities today. That all of that should be cut off at the federal level. And at the state level, they have to require diversity within these institutions. Florida's done some of this. Ohio's done some of it. But it's going to take a long time. That's not going to be an overnight process. That's why I propose the tax that I propose, the universal sales tax, because it's something that can translate into immediate effects that would revive the original view and the original institutions that come from the founding.
Again, our guest is Dr. Jeffrey Paul. His book is Winning America's Second Civil War. We just got a couple minutes left. In the arc of history now, you studied this and you wrote about it. Are you optimistic? I know one of the chapters, I forget which one now, you talk about counter-revolution, I think maybe the second or third chapter. And just in your answer just now, you said it's not going to happen overnight. Are you optimistic that you can turn back this you know, again, if it's competing systems, one our founding, which was so unique and singular, as you put it, the other now this progressive one that we can at least see in other parts of the world doing its damage. Are you optimistic that we can win this?
I'm cautiously optimistic. I think what the Trump candidacy represents is a candidacy that's, if successful, will stop many of the, well, let's say, change the trajectory of the way that the country is, the path that the country is following temporarily. But that's a temporary thing. And I think in order to have the Republican Party acquire, nothing's permanent, but a fairly long-term, immediate-term majority, my tax proposal is the only thing that I could think of while the rest of the institutions are being reformed. And that's because that's going to take a long time. To reverse what's transpired in the media, which is just simply a mirror of the university, is going to take a very long time. Our corporations are being corrupted as well, because all the people who run them have university degrees. So there's a view that it makes no sense that there's DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion in the private sector. But there is today. It's not just in universities. It's in publicly traded companies. And so that will show you the degree of corruption that has transpired. And everything that the current administration has done is, when you think about it and set back, it's appalling. It's actually appalling. You know, they've financed both sides of the Israeli war. They've allowed Iran to acquire huge sums of money, which it gives to its surrogates.
Right.
And it's kept this open border, and it's done it deliberately. So,
yeah, it is. It's extraordinary. Well, thank you, first of all, for the long conversation. I kept you longer than I had originally agreed. Dr. Jeffrey Paul, his book is Winning America's Second Civil War. Everywhere you get books, you can get it. I'm looking at it on Amazon, just out a few weeks ago. Very interesting topic, as well as take on things. So we will watch closely and have you back again. And thank you very much. We're up against the break, though. I've got to run. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the Phyllis Schlafly Report, presenting a daily conservative pro-family perspective since 1983 and continuing the legacy of Phyllis Schlafly. Now, from the Phyllis Schlafly Center Studios, Ed Martin.
All Americans remember slavery as a deeply regrettable mark in American history. It was an extremely divisive issue as far back as the American founding. It was so divisive that we even fought a civil war in this country to end it. The Civil War led to more dead American soldiers than any other war in our nation's history. After that, you would expect our country could easily unite around preventing any kind of slavery in this country again. Unfortunately, that just isn't the case, and that's all thanks to the disastrous border policies of President Joe Biden's administration. Instead of a transatlantic slave trade transporting slaves into the United States, as happened way back in early American history, the new slave trade is run by the Mexican cartels. These cartels are the new gatekeepers of the United States' southern border. With Biden's lack of border restrictions, illegal immigrants pay the cartels to smuggle them into this country. This allows the cartels to expand their enterprises, which of course means an increase in drug trafficking, among other illegal activities. And it also means an increase in human trafficking. Joel Berry noted on the X platform in February that in 3 years, Biden brought in as many unaccompanied minors, most of whom are trafficked for child labor and sex, as the total number of African slaves shipped to America during the entirety of the slave trade. Berry goes on and says, from 1619 to the end of the transatlantic slave trade in 1808, North America imported an average of 2,052 African slaves per year. Remarkably, this is only a fraction of the number of slaves entering the United States under Joe Biden. Last year alone, Berry noted, Biden facilitated the illegal importation of 130,000 trafficked children. Joe Biden's border policies have created this humanitarian crisis, as well as a sprawling slave trade of never-before-seen proportions. All of this must come to an end, but Joe Biden has proven he's unwilling to put a stop to it. Who will stop this?
This has been the Phyllis Schlafly Report from Phyllis Schlafly Eagles. America is safe only when America is strong. Our national defense requires the most modern technology and best-trained soldiers, and there should be no social politics or idle threats coming out of Washington. At PhyllisSchlafly.com, we take this work very seriously. Please visit PhyllisSchlafly.com. Thanks for listening, and join us again for the Phyllis Schlafly Report.
Hey, welcome back to the Pro America Report. This is Ryan Height. Glad to be here with you wrapping up the show. And we've got a little something I wanted to talk about, something that is brand new this week that I think is very relevant to all of us, very relevant here in the U.S., the rate that we're going, the direction that we're going. I wanted to talk about it just a little bit. Before we get there, though, let me remind you, go to proamericareport.com. ProAmericaReport.com. You can also head over to PhyllisSchlafly.com. ProAmerica Report, you will find Ed's Substack, what he is writing about, very good stuff, very important stuff. And then, of course, PhyllisSchlafly.com is where you will find all of the archives of this program and, most importantly, a sign up for the Wink email, what you need to know every morning into your inbox, every weekday morning. But we've got something to talk about today. Speaking of speaking, free speech. One of the pinnacles of American society, the freedom of speech enshrined in our First Amendment. You might remember, as we've talked about quite a bit here recently, that this freedom of speech is a recognized right, not a given right, meaning the government is recognizing, should I say, the federal government, its founders, recognizing this right exists naturally for all people, and the government, therefore, is not allowed to restrict or restrain it. Now, of course, this covers a lot of things, and it doesn't cover a lot of things. If you're making a physical threat to someone, hey, you, I'm going to kill you, you have 5 seconds to run, that's not, you know, going to fly. That doesn't work. If you walk into a crowded movie theater and yell fire and you're stirring up a public panic, that's not going to go well for you. But when it comes to all kinds of other things now that the left is saying, violent speech or all of the ridiculous phrasings we've heard, guess what? The whole reason that there is a freedom of speech, a protection of the freedom of speech, isn't because of the good stuff. It's because of the stuff that's uncomfortable. I mean, let's be honest. It sounds kind of cliche. You hear people say that. But truthfully, if we were just putting this down to protect speech that no one disagreed with, there wouldn't be any need for protections. The whole point is that America was founded upon the principle of dissent. We dissented from what was happening to us as British subjects. We were not being treated fairly as British subjects, and the king did not stand up for us against the cruelty of Parliament. We moved on. And upon moving on and doing our own thing and coming up with a system of government to protect the governing bodies that were here already, the freedom of speech was set down. Well, guess what? For 250 years, we have existed very well with that protection over the freedom of speech. But there are some neighbors and some close relatives who are having some difficulties. You might know about Canada's Gender Identity Rights Bill, C-16, which essentially, this has been around for a while. I think this was passed in 2017. But it's been changed and added and different things have happened. And essentially, this has set up a section of the criminal code targeting hate speech. But what it's done is allowed them to quite literally prosecute people under, what do they call it, the advocating genocide and the public incitement of hatred. They can include misgendering, mispronouncing someone is the phrasing now. Using an incorrect pronoun according to what someone wants to be called could potentially qualify as a crime. It is against criminal code to do that in Canada. Well, brand new, our not so much neighbors, but our close cousins over in Great Britain, Scotland, the northern part of the United Kingdom. Scotland yesterday just had a new law go into effect, which is rather disturbing. It is a new hate crime law. I think it was passed back in 2021. It has taken all the way until yesterday, April 1, April Fool's Day. How appropriate. April 1st of 2024 to come into full enforcement and full enactment. The Hate Crime and Public Order in Scotland What this is, they claim, is providing greater protection for victims and communities. But there's an incredible amount of concern over the freedom of speech. Now, this is essentially setting up a very, very new offense of threatening or abusive behavior, which is intended to stir up hatred. That is the phrasing of this new law. And it's on the grounds of age, disability, religion, sexual orientation, transgender identity, and variations in sex characteristics. Now, it's interesting that women aren't mentioned here, but I guess it's not in vogue for the left to protect women anymore or something like that. Well, this has definitely come under some incredible criticism because now we're talking about making all sorts of stuff a hate crime, and it's incredibly subjective. This has sparked massive protests and concern from the public there in Scotland, and a big voice, a very interesting big voice, J.K. Rowling. I'm not a Harry Potter fan. I don't know. J.K. Rowling has gotten into this. Now, she's gotten in hot water for being a feminist and a good liberal and everything else, but she's not a good enough leftist because she stops short of the transgenderism nonsense that is being foisted upon us. Well, she is a resident of Scotland. She has now dared the Scottish police to arrest her for calling a list of trans women men. Which is, you know, what they are, men who think that they're women. This is the kind of stuff that this is setting up. It is not very far away. This is not crazy stuff on the other side of the world. This is first world, very close to us countries, nations, Canada, Scotland, that are putting these things into effect. This is not, as you and I understand, insightful speech or something that does not qualify under the American First Amendment. This is a whole new realm of expressing an opinion that is not in lockstep with a radical and new agenda, I might add, and then being punished for it criminally according to the code, the law of your nation. Oh, man, this is dangerous stuff we're in. Dangerous stuff, indeed, this new hate crime and public order in Scotland. It makes me think very much of the Canadian law, and it reminds me very much of the direction that we are going in the United States. It is possible, not outside the bounds of possibility. We must be on guard and poking at every opportunity our legislators and our executives to make sure they know to stay far away from this nonsense, this anti-freedom nonsense. That's the wrap-up. That's what I've got for you today. Thank you for being with us. Thank you to Mason, my co-producer, for being on board this week and helping me. Thank you to Ed for being a host of this show typically and turning it over to us this week to run loose. And thank you most of all to you, our wonderful Pro America Report family, for listening, making this program what it is. We appreciate you, and we look forward to talking to you again tomorrow on another edition of the Pro America Report.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.